Well, please turn in your Bibles to Matthew 20. Matthew 20, we'll be, Lord willing, making our way through verses 20 to 28. You can find that on page 825 in your pew Bible. Matthew 20, verses 20 to 28, page 825 in your pew Bible. Verse 20 begins this way. Then the mother of the sons of Zebedee came up to him with her sons, and kneeling before him, she asked him for something. And he said to her, "What do you want?" She said to him, "Say that these two sons of mine are to sit, one at your right hand and one at your left in your kingdom." Jesus answered, "You do not know what you are asking. Are you able to drink the cup that I am to drink?" They said to him, "We are able." He said to them, "You will drink my cup, but to sit at my right hand and at my left is not mine to grant, but it is for those for whom it has been prepared by my Father." And when the 10 heard it, they were indignant at the two brothers. But Jesus called them to him and said, "You know that the rulers of the Gentiles lord it over them, and the great ones exercise authority over them. It shall not be so among you. But whoever would be great among you must be your servant, and whoever would be first among you must be your slave, even as the Son of Man came not to be served, but to serve and to give his life as a ransom for many." This morning, as we devote our time and attention to a glorious passage like what we just read, where we're talking about suffering and service and greatness, I want you to consider something before we dive into it. And when I ask this question, I want you to answer as truthfully as you can from your heart before the Lord. Do you want your life to matter? By God's strength and God's grace alone, do you want to stand before God knowing that you did everything in your power to make your life actually count? Do you care about these things, or are you content to waste your life going from day to day, not really with a plan, not really thinking through how you're going to give an account for this, not really thinking through how you can make an impact for the Lord? Are you satisfied living with your own sinful pleasure and your own purposes and caring very little about those around you and even less about the God who made you? I think more basically, some of you need to be asked, do you even think about these things? Do you ever give thought to what makes a life count, and more specifically, what makes your life count? As we listen to Christ speak to us in Matthew 20, we're going to get hit square between the eyes with things related to exactly what I'm asking you about. Christ is going to address suffering and service and glory and greatness and the desire to be first and how to love your neighbor, how to love him, all of these issues in Matthew 20:20-28. This is one of those passages that you cannot afford to zone out on if you ever hope to have a foundation in your life on which you're going to build for a life that matters. You see, like you, the disciples need help. They battled with sin. They struggled with sin. They had a hard time listening to the Christ they loved. Most obviously, they struggled with selfishness and pride. They were no strangers to wanting to be first. This is neither the first nor the last time they'll argue about priority in the kingdom. So when we watch them make fools of themselves in front of the Lord, which is what they're doing, it's easy to want to know what's wrong with them, but any sober thinking person doesn't take very long to realize you're prone to do this very same thing, even to a greater degree at times. Your secret is out. You struggle with loving God, you struggle with loving your neighbor. And on top of that, you struggle with loving God and loving your neighbor more than loving yourself. And so did the disciples. That's why we have passages like this in Matthew 20. Like you, they love to be first. I'm sure they could muster up the strength every now and then to let someone else go ahead of them or someone else have priority. But by and large, they really love to be first. That's why we have this kind of an argument so often in the passages. This is also why this passage is such a gift of grace from God, because in it, Jesus corrects them and teaches them, and because we have a living and active word, he's still talking to us, still teaching us about the same exact thing. We're going to see a patient Savior here, dealing with people who just aren't getting it. And the things they feel like they're getting, they're way off base on, and yet he's still patiently teaching them, and by his grace, still teaching us this morning. So as we approach this passage, make sure that you look at what Christ is saying about true greatness and take special interest in how greatness relates to suffering and serving, which will kind of help with our outline. We're going to have two easy points to comprehend this morning, hard points to swallow. Number one, I want you to see, in order to be great, you must embrace suffering. In order to be great, you must embrace suffering. In verse 20, Matthew starts off with then. Now, I know that's a simple little transition word, and if we take every word to this kind of degree, it will never end, right? But you can't miss this little transition in Matthew. We aren't sure exactly how long was between these two incidences. In 17 and 19, we looked at last week, Christ talks about his coming, suffering, death, and resurrection. And Matthew writes, then, and we're not sure how long, but we do see each of the gospel writers that record it put them right next to each other, and we also know it's on the same journey to Jerusalem. So it wouldn't have been very long if hardly any time had passed at all. So you're meant to read this question, request, debate. You're meant to read this in light of Jesus having just told them, we are going to Jerusalem, I'm going to be betrayed, I'm going to suffer and die, be crucified, and I'll rise. And so in verse 20, it says, then the mother of the sons of Zebedee came up to him with her sons, and kneeling before him, she asked him for something. So Jesus is approached sometime after making that announcement by the mother of the sons of Zebedee, which according to other passages are clearly James and John. Now, having read through this passage already at the beginning of the message, one of the things you may be wondering when you read this is, why would these two grown men bring mama up to Jesus? Why does she get involved in this discussion? And I'm not sure how many of you have looked into it. There are a few possible explanations. One of them must not be because we think they're shy guys. James and John were not shy. They weren't intimidated easily. They weren't bashful. One of the nicknames that they were given in other passages is the Sons of Thunder. And that's not meant to be ironic, like you call a slow person speedy, or you call a short person big guy, things like that. It's not meant to, it's real. They were the sons of thunder. They were not bashful people. So don't view this as them cowering and being afraid to talk to Jesus and afraid to speak their mind, and so they need mama to come along and do it. That's not what's going on. What it may be is they hope that their mom can get a request granted that maybe they couldn't. It could be the fact that the way men and women related at this time, maybe they thought she would be able to get away with certain things that they maybe couldn't have, and so, hey, there's this priority in the kingdom we really want to have. Could you go for us and ask this? Again, I know that he's Jesus, but in his real humanity, it still would be a little awkward to say no to mama, right? I mean, you've ever had your kids? I remember doing this. You ask if someone could come over, and they're right there in front of you. And you get the talk later. It's like, hey, don't ask me in front of the people if they can come over, because then it's a little more awkward. It could be setting up a situation like that. Hey, let's talk about James and John's priority in the coming kingdom, and let's have mama sitting right there, and let's make this a little bit more awkward for Jesus and probably get exactly what we want. It could be that. On top of that, it also could be another connection that I'll admit is not 100% airtight, but I am convinced of it. If you put together Matthew, Mark, and John, it seems best to take the mother of James and John to be the lady called Salome at the cross, which, when she's mentioned, is called Mary's sister. And so if that's true, which it seems to be, again, it's not 100% airtight, not only do you have two sons with mama coming up to Jesus, but you have two first cousins coming up to Jesus with Aunt Salome coming up to ask the question. This could be what's playing a role in what's going on here. But no matter what, we must read this seeing that the mother is simply a mouthpiece. We're not told about her motivation. She's not rebuked. We're not told that she was doing things sadistically or anything like that. We're not told any of that. The whole story hinges on talking through the mother, past the mother, to the two boys that were really putting her up to it. We know this because Mark doesn't even mention the mother. It says the two boys asked. We find out in Matthew they asked through their mom. We also know this because, as we'll see in a second, when Jesus goes to teach about what's being asked, he addresses the group. He doesn't address her. On top of that, when the other 10 hear what happened, they're mad at the two boys. They're mad at James and John. They're not mad at the mom. And so here she is with her two boys right beside her. They approach Jesus in, at minimum, a respectful way, possibly in a worshipful way. She bows down, and she's asking Christ for a favor. Verse 21, this is what she says. She approaches Christ for a favor. And Jesus says, "What do you want?" In Mark and in Matthew, you put it together. She basically says, I want to make a request. And so Jesus says, "What is it?" This isn't like, "What do you want?" Like, this isn't like that. And I pause here only to point out, he says, "What do you want?" I want you to never get tired of this, but the y'alls in the Bible matter. I'm a huge advocate. There's this website called yallversion.com. And you can put your translation that you prefer in, and it will change all the second person plurals to y'all to show you where it happens. This is a passage that's particularly helpful with that. So the mom and the two boys come up to Jesus, and she makes the request, or she says, "I want to ask you something." And he says, "What do you want?" It's a singular you. Verse 21, she responds. She said to him, "Say that these two sons of mine are to sit, one at your right hand and one at your left in your kingdom." Now, to anyone following the narrative in Matthew and even Mark, this request that she's just made could not be more inappropriate or insensitive or poorly timed, whatever you want to call it. Not only is it shocking that she's giving her attention to the glory of her sons and the coming kingdom of Christ, but it's also especially inappropriate after what he just said. He just said, "I'm going to suffer and die and be raised." And the first question he gets after that, according to the text in Matthew, is, "Can you make sure my sons get glory?" Now again, I want to give some credit. It's easy to beat up on the disciples and even the mom here. They do talk to Jesus as though he's king. They do believe he is king. They do believe that his kingdom's coming. I mean, this question is based on the assumption that what he's saying is true. Now again, I want to give credit there, but overall, this is a really bad question. And I was trying to think of a way to give an idea of a small taste of what this would have been like. And with Christmas coming up, imagine your family getting together. And within your family, there's one particularly highly beloved individual. And when everyone is together, that person says, "I've got an announcement to make. I just received news last week that I've got this terminal illness. There's nothing we can do about it. And I've only got a few weeks to live." I mean, just think of the feeling that would overcome the family. And then imagine one of your family members saying, "Can I get your TV?" It's like, "Are you kidding me? Like, you just heard what was just said about the terrible future of someone we love so much, and this is what you're interested in?" Again, Jesus just announced that he's marching to his suffering and death and resurrection, and they're looking out for themselves. They've even got their mom looking out for them as well. And last week, I tried to remind you of the humanity of Christ, that you need to remember to read Judas being an actual friend of his, a ministry partner, someone he spent a lot of time with. His backstabbing moves in the gospel would have been painful. And even here, remember the sadness this would have been for the third clear time that's recorded for us. I have to say, I don't know how many times he said it, but for the third clear time, he's given even more detail on his coming, suffering, death, and resurrection. And then to hear this question, I mean, just the amount of sadness that has to come over you that these are the people that I'm sent to serve. But again, instances like this remind us of how patient Christ is. These are true disciples, but they are severely mistaken here, and Christ doesn't get rid of them. He doesn't say, "Look, I've told you three times, you guys still aren't getting it. It's time to go to the bullpen. You guys got to get out of here. I'm getting some new ones." He doesn't do that. He doesn't yell at them and ask them if they're ever going to get with the program. He doesn't respond impatiently to their promotion of themselves over concern for him. He doesn't even rebuke them the way he does the prideful Pharisees. Instead, he once again patiently and lovingly teaches them. It's a helpful, encouraging picture of Christ being patient with his people that we see here. And getting back to the story, Jesus is asked by the mother about getting the left and right seats in his kingdom. Again, it's not entirely random. You're in Matthew 20. Look back at Matthew 19. Again, not being entirely sure of how close these events are. We know they're at least close enough to be called close together. Matthew 19, verse 28 says, "Truly," or Jesus said to them, "Truly, I say to you, in the new world," or in the regeneration, "when the Son of Man will sit on his glorious throne, you who have followed me will also sit on 12 thrones, judging the 12 tribes of Israel." I mean, he just said that in our Bible like 30 verses ago, 25 verses ago, whatever it is. But apparently that promise isn't good enough. Rather than in humility marveling that they'll be in the kingdom at all, rather than being awestruck that they're going to get thrones at all, these two, James and John, are making sure they get seat number 2 and 3. Christ gets 1. Obviously, we're not going to go for that one. We're not Satan. But we want 2 and 3. Again, I know we often associate left and right with honor and dishonor. Left being dishonor, right being honor. In the context and in the frame this is set up with the seating and the thrones, it wouldn't have been that big of a difference. There may have been some, but the issue is when you have the king sitting in the middle, the two next to him are the most important. And this is what they're going for. They wanted the place of priority. These brothers didn't specify which one wanted left, which one wanted right. They just wanted those two seats. They wanted those two seats ahead of the other 10. They wanted those two seats even ahead of Abraham and David and John the Baptist. They want prominence. Left and right didn't matter to them. The text doesn't say so. As long as it's not seats 3 through 12, we're good. And so Jesus responds by saying the question shows their ignorance. If you really understood what you were asking and what was going on, you'd never ask this question. Look at verse 22. Jesus answered, "You do not know what you are asking. Are you able to drink the cup that I am to drink?" You see, they're asking for glory and honor, but they're ignoring the cross that's coming. They want glory, but aren't considering the suffering that it requires. They want to be great while remaining ignorant of the pain and persecution that has to precede that. And again, like I told you, the y'alls matter. The mother and two sons approach Jesus. She says, "I want to ask you something." He says, "What do you want? You? What do you want?" And she says, "I want my sons to have prominence, seat left and right." And then he says, "Y'all don't know what y'all are asking." This is where it turns plural. Jesus starts talking, I think, to the two sons mainly. Past mama. Y'all don't know what you're doing. Again, it would be like seeing someone pull up next to you at a red light in a Ferrari and just knowing, "I want that." And someone's trying to explain to you, "Do you realize how much that cost?" "Nope, don't care. I just want it." It's like you have no clue what you're asking for. What kind of debt you'll go into? What kind of sacrifices have to be made to get something like that? This is, in a small sense, what's going on. Jesus knows their ignorance. So he asked them in verse 22, "Are y'all, you, able to drink the cup that I'm to drink?" Now, if you'll remember, I mentioned, as I said, the singular "you." Here Jesus is talking to y'all. He's talking to the two sons. He's talking to James and John directly, at least. Could involve the mom, but at least James and John. And he says, y'all are talking about my kingdom and glory that's coming. Do you have any clue what it's going to take to get there? You know that I'm going to have the prominent seat. Do you have a clue how I'm going to get to that seat? Jesus is highlighting for them the link between future rewards and glory and honor and present suffering. They're still not getting it. Like his cross predictions, this glory understanding is lost on them. After asking them if they're able to handle the cup that's required, they say in verse 22, "We are able." Man alive. I really believe they're genuine. I believe they're serious. But they're brash and speaking out of turn, speaking of things they have no clue about. Again, they say, a cup of suffering for more glory? I'll take it. Sign me up. I can handle that. So Jesus responds to the request, and he begins with a promise in verse 23. Look what he says. He said to them, again, to the two sons, y'all will drink my cup, but to sit at my right hand and my left is not mine to grant, but it is for those for whom it has been prepared by my Father. And it's here that in my study, I felt like I needed to make a helpful, necessary clarification. So often in Scripture, we come across this imagery of a cup. And I feel like in my thinking and even in my preaching, I've made it sound like every time a cup is mentioned, it's God's wrath. The reason that this is such a prominent theme is in the Old Testament, that is what it often refers to. the cup of God's wrath poured out on the nations, the cup of God's wrath that they'll drink down to the dregs. You know, when you get to the bottom of the cup and you're hitting it to make the last little drops come out, that's what the nations will drink. So I don't want to go back on that or confuse you on that at all. Christ is going to drink a cup that not only has the fury and wrath of man and persecution, but it has the fury and wrath of God against the sin of the people Christ is coming to redeem. Christ drank the cup of his Father's wrath so his people wouldn't have to. But the question comes up, well, if Christ took that cup of wrath from the Father, then that means his people won't taste a drop. Why does he say they'll have a cup to drink as well? And so that's where I think a helpful clarification is in order. Generically, in Scripture and even in the culture, a cup could refer to just suffering in general or shared experiences. We share a cup, we share experiences, or just a cup referring to a burden or suffering. So while the cup that the disciples will drink, James and John here, and we'll expand it later, while it will never include a single drop from the wrath of the Father, because Christ took that, it will be like Christ's cup, including in that it includes suffering. But again, not suffering from God's wrath, that's what Christ will drink for them in their place. Their suffering will come because they're connected to him, and their suffering will come from the wrath of men. Again, Christ's cup included both man's wrath and persecution and God's wrath for the sin of his people. Christ's cup is unique. It is not a cup that anyone else will drink the same way. But he does talk about, you will share my cup, meaning when you unite yourself to me, the persecution I'm receiving, you better buckle up for. Why would you expect to be treated better than the one you're following? If I speak truth and people hate me, and then you take my words and you speak those same words, what do you think's going to happen to you? Again, I've joked about this often. It's ironic that so many people think, man, if we were just more like Christ, the world would love us so much more. You know the reason the world doesn't love Christians more? Because they're not very Christ-like. It's like, have you ever read the Bible? Like, did you read about when he did come and he was the most Christ-like person ever because he's Christ and they killed him? Again, Jesus is promising James and John here that they will have a cup to drink. Similarly, the similarity between their cups is one of suffering. Again, not under God's wrath, but under man's wrath and persecution. Because they are uniting themselves to the Lord, they must expect the same treatment that he got. And we see this play out in history when in Acts 12, we learn that James here is martyred for his faith. We learn later in Revelation 1 that John would be sentenced to some sort of isolation, abandonment in the Isle of Patmos. It's that kind of suffering for Christ's sake that Christ guarantees here. And it's that kind of suffering that would not just be unique to them. All of the apostles of Christ, besides John, and there's different stories with how he escaped this and things like that, but all of the other apostles died a martyr's death. More than that, Jesus went on to teach through Paul that all who desire to live a godly life in Christ Jesus will be persecuted. And so if you want to follow Christ, you are signing up to be persecuted. If you want to avoid being persecuted, don't follow Christ. And the thing that needs to be clarified is you can't have both. You can't have a life that avoids persecution and follows Christ. Again, James and John have their minds set on glory and exaltation, but Jesus is telling them that comes with a price. You want to be great? You want to have glory in the age to come? Then suffer. Again, don't think that you'll get glory in the age to come if you're not suffering in the age that now is. Every single Christian must embrace this role of suffering that Christ has for them. It is inevitable. If you love Jesus, you will listen to Jesus. And when you listen to Jesus and you believe what Jesus says, you talk like Jesus, so therefore you get treated like Jesus. And so following Christ makes persecution inevitable unless, and I want you to hear me, it is possible for a Christian to escape persecution, but only if they sin, only if you compromise. So if you say, well, I'm a Christian, and I'm not really facing persecution in any way, that means you're not following Christ like you're supposed to. Doesn't mean you're not following him at all. Doesn't mean you don't love him at all. But you're clearly not being very Christ-like if the world that hated him loves you. This is what Christ is preparing them for. He doesn't want them in the ages to come or the years to come. He doesn't want them to start suffering and say, are we messing up here? Are we doing something wrong? Does God hate us? Is that why we're persecuted? He's preparing them now for things they don't get yet, but they will later. So this is the lesson that must be heard and embraced by all who would claim to love and follow Jesus. It's unavoidable unless you compromise. But a life that avoids suffering is not a life of self-denial that Jesus demands. A life that avoids suffering and persecution is not a life that takes up the cross or shows that Christ means more to you than your siblings and parents and spouse. It's not a Christian life. Following Christ is costly, but here's what I want to encourage you with. If you actually are convinced Christ is glorious, it's worth it. If you're convinced Christ is who he said he is, if you're convinced that Christ is the way, the truth, and the life, then you will suffer reproach for his name because you'd rather have him than be comfortable now and lose him. Again, it's because you're convinced that Christ is great. It's not because you just pump yourself up and try to convince yourself that persecution is not that bad. No, it's terrible. There are mild forms and more severe forms, but all forms are not fun. That's not the way we get through it. The way you get through persecution is by knowing and actually believing in your heart that Christ is worth it. Enduring necessary persecutions is possible only if you're convinced Christ actually is worth the suffering. And so when you join in suffering for Jesus' sake, we learn from Paul that there's a fellowship with Christ that you enjoy that you would never know otherwise. As if that weren't enough, when you endure persecutions that come with the territory of being a disciple of Christ, another blessing of it is it makes you really ready to be in the age to come. It reminds you, this world's not my home. I am a stranger. I am a pilgrim. It's so easy for us, as I was even opening up the service, it's so easy for us to start to cling to the things of the world. Well, when the world turns on you, it's a lot easier to remember, oh yeah, I'm not here forever. So persecution not only helps you love and fellowship with Christ better, it also helps you in your fight against worldliness. It helps you long more for the age to come. Again, it's easy to cling to this world as we live in it day after day, but persecution has a way of curing you of that. Comfort in this life makes it easier to love the things of the world and make the age to come stranger and stranger to you. That's not the way it was meant to be. And so after making it clear that they will have a drink from their own cup like he does, Jesus then addresses their main request about the thrones, and he gives a very simple answer. Look, it's the Father who grants that. That's not my prerogative right now. That's not what I'm here to do. You're asking me about something I'm not here to grant. I am here to promise you, though, if you follow me, you'll suffer. Again, you worry about faithfulness. Let God worry about the rewards. And with that, the first point seems to be wrapped up. In responding to the plea that they desired for prominence, Jesus makes it clear that any sort of glory in the future must necessarily be entered into through suffering. So if you want the greatest glory, you have no clue what you're asking for. If you don't understand, it will come with the greatest suffering. So again, if you're not committed to suffer, you shouldn't be thinking about prominence in the world to come. So first, in order to be great, you must embrace suffering. But secondly, in the rest of the passage, we're going to see, in order to be great, you must embrace serving. So in order to be great, you must embrace suffering. Secondly, you must embrace serving. And it's at this point in the narrative that the disciples put their ignorance on display. We haven't heard from the other 10 at this point. And I'm not trying to be mean to them, but Luke told us last week that when Christ announced his coming suffering, death, and resurrection, they didn't get it. I told you, he said it 3 different ways in 1 verse. They didn't get it. They didn't understand it. It was hidden from them. And they show that they didn't get it with this. Look at verse 24. When the 10 heard it, they were indignant at the two brothers. When they heard James and John ask Jesus for this, even if it was through their mom, they were furious, indignant, the ESV says. And notice, they were mad at the two brothers, like I said. But they're not mad for the reason that you might think. Again, go back to our example of family gathering together. You got the highly beloved family member who just announced, I've got weeks to live. And then you've got the boneheaded cousin who says, can I have your TV? You're mad at that point, right? But you're mad because you're embarrassed. What if it was your child who asked that to a grandparent? It's like, are you kidding me? Did I raise you that way? You thought that was appropriate? How disrespectful and rude to be concerned about things like that when this was just stated. That would be why you would be mad in that moment. That's not why the other 10 are mad. The other 10 are mad more likely because they think they're about to lose out to James and John. It would be like in that moment hearing someone go, "Can I have your TV?" And it's like, "Ah, oh, I should have asked earlier." That is what's going on in this. It's more like a classmate that finds out another classmate cheats. And they're not mad they cheated. They're mad they cheated in a way they didn't think of and got away with it. That kind of thing. If the other 10 had thought about a way to ask this kind of a, or make this kind of a request earlier, they would have done it. On this point, D.A. Carson makes this summary. He says, "The indignation of the 10 doubtless sprang less from humility than jealousy, plus the fear that they might lose out." Again, put yourself in Jesus' shoes for a moment. This is your 12 disciples. These are. This is who you're dealing with. They clearly misunderstand their need to suffer, and now it's obvious they don't understand the priority of serving. So Jesus gathers those 12 together and teaches them by pointing them to the pagan rulers. Look at verse 25. It says, "But Jesus called them," so now it seems like he's got all 12 together, "and said, 'You know that the rulers of the Gentiles lord it over them, and their great ones exercise authority over them.'" Jesus says, "Look, just lift your eyes up and look around. Just look at the way the world works and their rulers." Obviously, most closely being able to look at the Romans at that time. "Look at how they love to be on top. Look at how they not only love to be on top, but they love to use their authority for their own benefit and purposes. And look at how they often use their benefit and purposes while being on top to the harm of those under them." We see that even in our day with some of the ridiculous hypocrisy in leaders that make these rules that they're not following. This is not something that's new to our culture. It's ever since the fall. People, especially rulers and people who are given authority, they love to promote themselves, and they often will do it to the harm of others. And Jesus points to them, and he says, "Look, this is how you're acting. This is what this is all coming from. You love yourself, you're promoting yourself, no matter what the cost is." Again, they want the kingdom to come, absolutely, but it seems like they want the kingdom to come because they'll finally get the authority that they're desiring. The disciples were nobodies in some sense. For the most part, they weren't the high people of society. They were men who were lower. Nothing very special about them. And add to that, now they've hitched their wagon to a blasphemer who's talking about these kingdom realities that you look around, "I don't see this. What are you talking about? Now you're saying you're God." I mean, you got to think about the persecutions they would have endured for this. It would have been easy to think, "Man, I would love to be in charge just for a minute. Just let me show them what they do to me. Let me get a little bit even with them." Again, it seems like it would be easy to understand the disciples wanting the kingdom to come just so they can get back at the ones that are persecuting them. This is very easy to see in their thinking, and Jesus points it out. That is a pagan way of looking at authority and greatness and being first. It has no place among his people. Look at verse 26. "It shall not be so among you." Again, that's the way of the world. It is not the way of Christ. The way that you're acting is the way of the current kingdom. It's not the way of the coming kingdom. What should you do instead? Verse 26 again. "But whoever would be great among you must be your servant, and whoever would be first among you must be your slave." So rather than seeking to be over people and have authority to promote yourself, even if it means harming those under you, you've got to seek being great by being a servant, and seeking to be first by being a slave is what Jesus says. Again, I know that we commonly, and I've done this before, we call this backwards thinking. We go, "Man, look how backwards Jesus is here." But notice the perspective we're speaking from. There's nothing backwards about this. There's everything backwards about us. Jesus' words all face the right way and are all pointed the right direction. We're the ones that go the other way. Jesus is saying here, greatness is found in serving each other and being a slave to one another. That's where greatness is found. We hear that and we go, "No, it's not. That's so backwards." It's not backwards. It's the way it should be. Again, Christ's words come across here as a problem for us only because sin is so pervasive in our lives and in our society. Jesus says, "You want to be great? Great." He doesn't actually critique the desire to be great here. Jesus doesn't critique the desire to want to be first here. The problem with wanting to be great isn't wanting to be great. The problem with wanting to be first isn't wanting to be first. It's the way you go about being great and the way you go about being first. Jesus says, you want to be great, then be a servant. You want to be first, then be a slave. Again, he's telling them how to accomplish what is a fine desire. And your problem is not necessarily with the desire, it's how you're seeking to accomplish it. The word for servant here, you'll notice in other passages, is actually translated deacon. That's where we get the word servant. You can translate it assistant. So Jesus is saying, you want to be great? Then be an assistant to people. Help them, serve them, consume yourself with helping meet their needs and accomplish their goals. Make it your life's goal to make their life's goal happen. This is what Jesus is pointing them to, and it will mean that you give up time and money and desires and goals. But again, the question is Christ worth it? What means more to you, getting your selfish desires fulfilled or loving Christ and fellowshipping with him in a way that you serve others around you? Again, being selfish or being a servant. True servants commit themselves to meeting the real needs of those around them, even at great cost to themselves, which is such a contrast from the world. They will serve themselves at great cost to those under them. Christians, disciples, serve others at great cost to themselves. Again, Jesus says, you want to be first? How you go about it makes all the difference in the world. If you want to be first, you must be the slave of those around you. That word for slave, that concept would have been very familiar to them. There's some reports that up to a third of all of Rome was enslaved at some point, whether it was prisoner or enslavement or some sort of captured thing or whatever, war. About a third of all Romans understood personally what slavery was like. So the language would have been well understood by them. Jesus is saying, you want to be first? No problem. Put yourself in the lowest class of society. Consume yourself with the needs and the wills of those around you. Treat yourself as though your life doesn't belong to you. View others as your master and seek to please them as best as you can. That's how you become great, by serving. That's how you become first, by enslaving yourself. And again, for slaves, nothing was beneath them. And I do mean nothing. There's reports from all sorts of societies where slavery in this area of the world, something as simple as public toilets were made out of marble slabs. Marble slabs, I've heard, get cold. So no one wants to sit on that, right? So what do? You take your slave and you say, warm it up for me. You sit first, and then I'll come sit. I mean, that's what I mean by nothing is beneath you. This is why the contrast is so clear. The world seeks to be over people in authority. Disciples seek to be under people in service. The world seeks to use people for personal gain, and disciples seek to serve others for their good. The world uses authority to help and promote themselves. Disciples use authority to help and promote others. The world seeks to benefit themselves, even if it means harming others, and disciples seek to benefit themselves or others, even if it means harming themselves. That's the contrast. But if you want the best example of what it means to be this kind of a servant, deacon, this kind of a slave, look at verse 28. Even as, such as, Jesus has already set the standard, and now he's pointing you to the example. You have got to be a servant and a slave if you want to be great and first, just like me. He's pointing to himself. Verse 28, even as the Son of Man came not to be served, but to serve and to give his life as a ransom for many. Jesus, again, pointing to himself. You want to know what kingdom greatness looks like? Look at Jesus. You want to know what the pathway to greatness and prominence looks like? Again, look to Christ. Look specifically at his purpose for coming to the earth. He starts off negatively by saying, look, I did not come to be served. I did not come to be served by the people that I came to serve. I came to serve them, not the other way around. And that is an amazing statement on so many levels. He calls himself the Son of Man. Jesus was convinced that he is the divine human king that God intended to rule. And that's the one saying, I didn't come to be served. The uncreated one, the creator. The infinitely glorious God of the universe taking on humanity, taking on a real human nature. If anyone ever had the right to not only expect, but demand that you serve them, it was him. And yet he didn't do it, not in his first coming at least. He came to be a deacon, the passage says, or a slave according to what he was just teaching. He came not to be served, but to serve. That is humility, and I mean this in the truest sense. You can't comprehend that. You think it's hard for you to be humble. You're nothing. He is the Lord of the universe, and yet he's the most humble. You may pick up crumbs of this every now and then and get small insights to Christ's humility, but you will never fully grasp it. Christ came to serve and to heal and deliver and feed and teach and resurrect. He came to pray and so much more. But as great as those things are, that's not actually what he highlights as his service. When we think of Christ's humility, we think of so many things that he came to do. Most likely, your mind turns to when he washed their feet, which is a humble act. But notice what he points to. He says, if you want to be great, be a servant. If you want to be first, be a slave like me. And the example of how he is a servant and a slave is in verse 28 there, to give his life as a ransom for many. He points to the fact that infinite God, taking on a real human nature, did so to give it up and lay it down for the benefit of others and in the place of others. Now again, why would he do this? He says to give his life as a ransom for many. So Christ's giving up of his life is a payment so that others could be ransomed or freed. Again, I want to be clear here with what we do mean by give his life, because the way we use that phrase today is not the way the Bible means that phrase. Let me explain a setting that will show you what I mean. Imagine if there's a teacher that's been a faithful teacher for 40 years in a local school. So at their retirement, they are rightly applauded for what they've done. And they may say something like, "We're so glad that you gave your life to this job." What we mean by gave your life is you gave it your all, your energy, countless hours, untold sums of money. There's so much you poured into this. You gave it your full effort. That's what we mean by gave your life. That is not what Christ is saying here. He's not giving his life as far as just effort. He's actually literally giving his life. He's dying in the place of sinners. Again, why would Christ do this? It's because his people are in bondage. The only acceptable payment for their release is his precious blood. His life is the ransom payment that they need. And it's a payment that once paid secures the freedom of the captive or the slave on which it was paid. There was no instance where the price was paid and the person wasn't released. And so Jesus says, "I came to give my life as a ransom for many, and those he gives his life for will be freed." Since the fall, all people are in bondage to sin, and in order to save his people, in order to free his people, to redeem his people, Jesus made this payment to the Father. This payment was not made to Satan. Satan doesn't have that kind of authority. He is enslaved himself. This payment wasn't made to men. This payment wasn't made to sin, as though sin's something you can pay. It was to the Father. It was the Father's curse that was on these people that he was setting out to save. They were his enemies, and now he's the one footing the bill for it. He's sending his son to pay the price that is required in order to remain just when he justifies sinners. And so this is the perfect illustration of what Christ requires of his disciples. Jesus points to himself, and particularly his life-giving ransom that he's going to pay on behalf of many, or in the place of many. He shows what it looks like to seek to be under others as a servant, serving us exactly the way we need it before we were ever thankful for it, before we ever realized it, before we ever knew we needed it. He's still doing it at great cost to himself, taking care of our needs above his own in many instances, and even taking care of our needs to his own personal shame and false accusations and murder. Again, rather than using his eternally glorious nature for his own selfish promotion, Christ humbles himself by adding a human nature and becoming obedient in that, according to that humanity, not just to the point of death, but Philippians 2 says, even death on a cross. And he does this for us while we were yet his enemies. This is the great Savior that we're reading about in Matthew 20. This is part of why Christians are irresistibly drawn to Christ. I can't imagine walking away from this. And if you can, it's because you're blind. So if you hear this and you go, yeah, it doesn't do anything for me. It's like saying the sun's not bright. It's not because the sun's not bright, it's because you're blind. When you read about what Christ does to serve his people, there's an irresistibility to that. I've got to come to him. Do I come imperfectly? Absolutely. But I can't walk away from this glorious Savior. We are convinced that he is glorious. Christ is amazing. And because we want to know him and love him as best as we can, we endure many hard things. There's suffering that comes with that, but it's worth it because we get Christ. And I'd rather have Christ than all the comfort in the world. I'd rather have Christ than all the friends in the world. I'd rather have Christ than any of that. And so you must not only hear the words of Christ concerning true greatness, but you must think hard on them and give mental energy and prayer and time to think of how these words especially apply to you. Think of all the calls to suffering and service that you have in your life. Some of you more than others. Some of you, I know it's not our normal way of thinking, but Philippians 1 calls suffering a gift. It says it was granted to you not only to suffer, but to believe. So the same way that faith is a gift, suffering's a gift. And some of you, God gives more suffering to. And in full disclosure, I was trying to think through some applications of this, and I just kept being drawn back to the family, probably because I'm reading about mama and the boys and in the passage. But think seriously about a life of service just as a parent, especially you mothers. You know what service is like. Thankless service, seemingly fruitless service. You give your body to receive a child. You give your body to grow a child, painfully deliver a child, feed the child, lose sleep to help the child, lose personal preferences, even lose personal privacy and the bathroom door never working and things like that. And that's just with one kid, much less if you go to Cornerstone, you have 12. That's... Mothers understand, give. It's a very Christ-like understanding of life. And for many of you, it often seems pointless or without reward. And on top of that, on top of how hard it is already as a sinner, on top of that, you have a world telling you you deserve better. You know what? Your life could be so great if motherhood wasn't getting in the way. Just farm raising the kids out, taking care of the house. Just farm that out to somebody. You go do you, pursue you. That's where your real fulfillment's in. This makes it even worse. This makes it even more difficult to endure the thankless, give type life. And so these words from Christ ought to be very precious to you. You want to be great? Keep serving. Consume yourself with the wills of another or the will of another, or even others, even if they're 2 years old, or 12, or 14, or whatever it is. But it's not just you. And thinking through the family, this goes with husbands and fathers as well. You want to be great men, or great husbands, or great dads? Serve. Don't enter the home, which is so tempting to do, don't enter the home ready to just be done for the day. I'm going to throw my feet up. I'm here to be served. This is my domain, my kingdom. Go fetch me a drink. That's not the way that we show Christ-like service. That's not the way we lead by example. Christ led by example from out in front. As dads, as husbands, we go as low as required to meet the needs of those around us. We go as low as we need to be the servant or slave or deacon of our home. And the same is true with many of you who even serve here in the church, thinking outside the family to the church now. There's only so many nursery slots you can fill before you start questioning your decisions in life. Man, it's hard to watch my kids, and now I'm inviting other people's kids to just throw them in, yeah. That's hard, and oftentimes seems thankless. Maybe you teach a class that doesn't seem to bear much fruit. Maybe you're meeting with someone that seems to not be going anywhere. Again, these words from Christ are helpful. He's dealing with people that don't seem to be going anywhere. He's dealing with people who just don't seem to get it. He's given them 3 years, and they're just not getting it. Again, this is encouragement for all of us as we serve and seek to be a slave to those around us. True greatness is found in us being consumed with what people need rather than what we always want. Because sometimes what people need is not necessarily what we want. Again, this is a worldview change that shifts everything in your life, even things as simple as attending church. Just think about this morning. I don't know if you realize this, but you're here. You are in church this morning. And we use that language, like church is people, but you're in this assembly this morning. Why? So often we leave saying, what'd you think about the service? Or, well, I didn't like this or that. Or I'm reflecting on all the ways I wasn't served this morning. Is that why we're here? I mean, if we're following Christ's words here in all of life, that means I've got a different worldview, a mindset when I'm coming to church. I'm not demanding people be there that look just like me. I'm not demanding people be there that are easy. I'm just showing up to see who I can serve and help. I'm showing up to see who I can submit myself to and enslave myself to. We have to fight against this consumer mentality, a what's in it for me type attitude. Again, think through how God might use you even before you walk in the doors. How can God use me and my mouth today to talk to other brothers and sisters to encourage them? Or maybe there's someone who's been visiting, I don't even know who they are. How can I talk to them in an encouraging way? How can I sing, even if I don't like the sound of my voice? How can I sing loudly because the words we're singing are so helpful to be heard that loudly? This is the way that we show up for even something as simple as Sunday morning assembly, with an idea of serving and enslaving ourselves to other people. That's what Jesus is requiring in every area of your life. To think first and foremost, what do other people need? Not always, what do I want to do? To take that mindset of a servant and a slave, that is the pathway to true greatness. Again, it's this kind of a life that is perfectly exemplified in Christ. Christ is the one who lives this way, not just lived, but lives this way still today, setting an example for us, yes, but also doing it to actually accomplish what we need, to be forgiven of the countless acts of selfishness that we have, but also to forgive us, give us righteousness that we need to be justified, but also to empower us, to change us. Christ actually can and loves to take selfish people and make them selfless people like himself. And that is the promise of the gospel, not just forgiveness, as if that weren't enough. Not just the gift of your sins removed and righteousness given to you, but on top of that, he promises a change from the inside out. That those times where you realize, yeah, I am selfish, and you hate it, he's there saying, I'm here to help. That is what Christ is here to do. May we always and only rely on Christ alone for the grace we need to do this. To love God and our neighbor more than ourselves as we seek to suffer and serve for his glory. Let's pray.